From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, we hear what the FBI had to say about William Faulkner, John Steinbeck, and other celebrated writers. Herbert Mittgang of the New York Times got copies of FBI files on writers for his new book, Dangerous Dossiers. Also today, candidates Paul Simon and Pat Robertson, as interpreted by comedian Al Franken. Al Franken writes for and performs on Saturday Night Live. Rock historian Ed Ward examines the career of the band Brinsley Schwartz, which helped start the pub rock scene in England. And book critic John Leonard reviews two new biographies of Roy Cohn, who rose to prominence as chief counsel to Joseph McCarthy during the UAC hearings. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. While the books of some of America's greatest writers were being reviewed in the press, the writers' lives were under surveillance by the FBI. We now know that under J. Edgar Hoover, the FBI kept files on many writers suspected of somehow undermining the American way of life. The suspicious activities ranged from signing a petition to joining a guild or union, supporting a controversial cause, or allegedly having communistic tendencies. Sinclair Lewis, William Faulkner, Ernest Hemingway, Carl Sandburg, Dorothy Parker, Thomas Wolfe, Thornton Wilder, Lillian Hellman, and Tennessee Williams are just some of the writers the FBI kept files on. New York Times cultural correspondent Herbert Mittgang used the Freedom of Information Act to request the FBI files of these and other illustrious writers. Mittgang's findings are the subject of his new book, Dangerous Dossiers, Exposing the Secret War Against America's Greatest Authors. Mittgang is a former president of the Authors Guild and current president of the Authors League Fund. I asked him why he wanted to research the dossiers that had been kept on writers.
Well, I wanted to see if there was really a pattern to them, to see if it wasn't just some casual individual who was being checked because of what he had written, but rather because of a entire anti-intellectual feeling that existed in the FBI and in other agencies of the federal government. And it started to grow that way, beginning with Carl Sandburg and going on to a half dozen Nobel laureates in literature.
So what did you find? Were there patterns?
Well, there was a pattern because there was the Authors Guild, the Authors League, and the Dramatists Guild, and they were being watched by mail watches, by infiltrating their meetings, notices of their meetings, their documents. And these, of course, included thousands of members in both guilds. And this was a pattern that continued right from, the 1930s, right until into the 1960s.
Now, you are a former president of the Authors Guild. Why was it spied on? Was it considered a subversive organization?
Well, it's related to what these authors were writing for, and also some of their associations. Many major American writers were sympathetic during the Spanish Civil War to the Loyalist side. That immediately got them into trouble. I don't know if the FBI was keeping track of those on the pro-Franco side. At least I didn't discover any. But famous, most of the great writers in the United States were on the Loyalist side. John Dos Passos, Dorothy Parker, Ernest Hemingway. They were all supporters of the Loyalists against Franco's fascist regime, which incidentally was supported by Nazi Germany and Mussolini's troops. And so this got them records. Then through Spanish war relief, after the defeat of the Loyalists, many of them lent their names to support refugees. And so this, again, got into their files. You have some of the Hemingway books, of course, like the Fifth Column play and book. These were considered subversive documents in the eyes of J. Edgar Hoover.
Are you especially outraged when writers are the targets of investigations?
Well, I'm not especially outraged because that's an interesting point. I've never felt that writers were any better than anybody else in the country. It happens that they are more visible. They are public performers in print, and therefore they are called upon more often to write supportive documents, occasionally to run for public office, to testify before Congress. And no, I'm not outraged that authors are. I'm outraged that any Americans are subjected to having files on them because it's an invasion of their right of privacy under the Constitution.
Let me reintroduce you. My guest is Herbert Mittgang. He's a cultural correspondent for the New York Times and the author of the new book, Dangerous Dossiers, Exposing the Secret War Against America's Greatest Authors. Now, you had to do a lot of detective work to put this book together. Did you send for Freedom of Information Act files on the authors that you were curious about?
Yes. Thanks to the Freedom of Information and Privacy Act, which was a product, came in the aftermath of the Church Committee hearings, after Watergate in 1974, I was able to obtain the dossiers on, about 100 different authors, dramatists, even some musicians, composers, and artists. I was, it started out, I had really no intention to write this book, to tell you the truth. It started out almost as a curiosity with one author, Carl Sandburg, whose letters I had edited at his request, the request of his family. And I was amazed that this icon of American poetry and history would have a file of some 100 pages. And then I said, well, if Carl Sandburg has a file, there must be other people who have files. And so I thought I'd start with the top, the half-dozen American Nobel laureates in literature. And so I wrote away for the files under the Freedom of Information Act on Sinclair Lewis, Pearl Buck, William Faulkner, Ernest Hemingway, John Steinbeck, and Thomas Mann, who became an American citizen in 1944. And much to my amazement, all of them had files. And then I started to broaden out from them and sometimes said, I'm going to play a little game with myself. I'm going to ask for files of the most outrageous tests of file keeping and record keeping. And that is people who I'm sure did not have a file, like E.B. White. Well, E.B. White had a file, which meant that they were looking after Stuart Little. I thought, what have they got against a little mouse?
Well, what did they have against E.B. White?
Well, he was listed in there because he was. It was a very small file, but he was investigated, looked into as a possible subversive. And only he could have exposed this in writing. Actually, the files themselves, and his case was an example, were quite naive. E.B. White had actually attacked J. Edgar Hoover and record keeping in a number of cases, and I even used one of his little poems as an epigraph in the book from a poem called I Spy, and which went something like this. In darkling street they seek and hide. The game grows wild and drunken. They spy upon the other side, keep secrets in a pumpkin. Well, E.B. White could hardly have imagined that he was one of the people having a dossier. But it just went on and on.
Let's get back to some of the award-winning writers that you mentioned who had dossiers kept on them. William Faulkner, what did you find in his dossier?
Well, William Faulkner had supported some black man who had been convicted of a crime in the South without the proper, in his opinion, jury, and that this black man had been railroaded. And so Faulkner was one of the authors and other citizens who objected to this man's pursuit by the government. Well, this was enough to enable Faulkner to have a file kept on him. He also had other things in his file. He was a supporter also of some civil rights causes, just the normal things. And he was known, actually, in his writing as quite sympathetic for a gentleman from Mississippi to civil rights causes.
Can you tell us briefly what you found on John Steinbeck?
Well, Steinbeck was a specific case where a man's career was harmed because of what he actually wrote. The Grapes of Wrath, and right in the file on Hemingway, it says so. The Grapes of Wrath was...
You mean in the file on Steinbeck?
And the file on Steinbeck, excuse me. The file on Steinbeck specifically said that The Grapes of Wrath, his famous novel, which was really the cause of him receiving a Nobel Prize in Literature, was a subversive document, anti-American, and obviously pro-labor, and the people who were involved, the migratory workers, were not to be trusted, and anyone who wrote about them was not to be trusted. And there's actual criticism of Steinbeck's novel in his file by these unnamed literary critics in the FBI. At the same time, thereafter, that novel was written during the Depression, but around 1942, John Steinbeck was writing speeches voluntarily for President Roosevelt and others in the government. And he decided he wanted to get into uniform. And so he applied to be a second lieutenant in the Army, this very famous American writer. The FBI killed his attempt to get into uniform by calling him a subversive, and the Army then would not allow Steinbeck to get into uniform at the very time that he was writing speeches for President Franklin D. Roosevelt.
You know what I thought was interesting? You got the file on Aldous Huxley, who was the author of Brave New World, among other things. And you found out that Brave New World was subjected to cryptographic examination. Does that mean that they thought that there were secret messages encoded in Brave New World?
Yes, they thought that there was something in the book that was... sending messages to the enemy, when Huxley, of course, was really exposing the brave new world of an authoritarian regime rather than a democratic one.
Well, I want to talk with you more about some of the things that you found that the FBI had been finding on famous writers. But first, we're going to take a short break. My guest is New York Times cultural correspondent Herbert Mittgang. His new book is titled Dangerous Dossiers, Exposing the Secret War Against America's Greatest Authors. Basically, what he did was get the Freedom of Information Act FBI files on many of America's famous authors and find out what the FBI was keeping track of these writers for. So we'll talk more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Herbert Mittgang. We're discussing the subject of his new book, Dangerous Dossiers, about FBI files on famous writers. A couple of very funny things come up in your research. For instance, Nelson Algren, the former Chicago-based writer, had a romantic relationship with Simone de Beauvoir for a while, and that led to a very peculiar thing in his FBI file. Would you explain the story?
Yes, well, Nelson was a man with a great sense of humor, a great cynic, and now that he's being revived, a lot of people think a very great naturalistic writer in this century. Nelson did have an affair with Simone de Beauvoir. He told me that the lady exaggerated in her novel, The Mandarins. But nevertheless, Algren could be very funny. Well, he was living in Gary, Indiana. And in the FBI file on him, it said Nelson Algren, and then it's had various aliases, among them Simon Beauvoir, Simone de Beauvoir, Simon de Beauvoir. And I thought, now, how did this happen? And so I went to the public library through a very nice librarian in Indiana, and sure enough, Nelson, as a gag, had used the name Simon de Beauvoir as his telephone listing. There was no Nelson Algren in the same directory. And so this threw the whole FBI into turmoil in his file. And I wanted to test the critics in the FBI, and so I wrote away to them after receiving this file and said, do you know why Nelson Algren used the alias Simon de Beauvoir? Didn't you know that this was his lady friend for several years? They never would give me an answer.
So you think that they weren't really in on other figures in the literary world?
I don't think so. That was not from there. They were rather unsophisticated in these raw files.
One other kind of funny sidebar that came up, the scholar and statesman John Kenneth Galbraith had a file that was kept on him, and I think as the story went, someone had said that he was doctrinaire, and the informant who was taking this down misunderstood and thought that they were calling him Dr. Ware. How did that show up in his file?
Well, again and again in his dossier, the FBI was in hot pursuit of this strange individual called Dr. Ware, W-A-R-E, who they thought was some sort of dangerous person. They were thrown into confusion for some 20 years looking for Dr. Ware. And as John Kenneth Galbraith told me, do you know, on me alone, the FBI must have expended hundreds of thousands of dollars just keeping records on me, having my mail watched, what I wrote watched, and looking for Dr. Ware, the non-existent Dr. Ware.
J. Edgar Hoover, during his reign over the FBI, was famous for keeping such files on Americans. When Hoover left the FBI, were files on writers like this still kept up?
Yes. Many of these files continue to this day. That is one of the major points I have made in the book, that once your name gets in a file, it does not get expunged. There's only one case that I know of where a writer had his file expunged after, about a 10-year effort in going through the courts. But the once your name is in a file, it's just kept up.
Do you have reason to believe that the files are still being updated?
I think that they are. Whenever your name pops into, especially with some activity which is not considered to the liking of the present government, I think the file is kept up or a new file started. And this all emerged in the last couple of months during the cases of there was an organization that was supporting the anti-government forces in El Salvador called CISPIS. Well, it turns out that many of these people were writers, and they were people from other organizations, including organizations of nuns, some of whom, unfortunately, were killed, and some of their sisters were in there on nursing and other duties. These people, we discover, were being watched both in this country and whenever they traveled abroad. So right, these revelations have come out right until 1988 and continued with FBI Director William Webster.
Now, it's interesting. President Reagan figures into your book in part under the name of Agent T-10.
Yes. President Reagan was president of the Screen Actors Guild in 1947 and very active in that guild. At that time, at the very same time that he was supposedly serving his fellow actors, he was a secret agent for the FBI spying on his fellow actors. I have that file, and in it he was called Agent T-10. That was his code name. Now, how did that come out while he was in the office, since he's not only in the White House, but he's also a living person? And most of the time, the files that I have concerned individuals who are no longer here. There was no objection to giving out his files, in my opinion, because I think that Attorney General Meese undoubtedly went through, it went all the way up to him, was rather proud of the fact that his president was also an FBI agent. Well, that's a matter of opinion and philosophy.
Could you get an understanding from the information you found what kind of informing that Ronald Reagan did while he was in the Screen Actors Guild?
Yes, he was looking at those members of his organization who may have been members of the Communist Party. And in fact, he then went to testify before the House Un-American Activities Committee. That's, I think, the first picture in my book showing Ronald Reagan wearing glasses, not contact lenses, and testifying before the House Un-American Activities Committee about the communist cells in Washington. Incidentally, nobody ever proved that there was one Hollywood movie that followed a Communist Party line or advocated the Soviet system over the American. I've yet to see or hear of one film that was ever made that was a pro-Soviet, anti-American film.
Now, your book, Dangerous Dossiers, is based largely on information you got through the Freedom of Information Act, and this is the act that enables you to get FBI files, and to make open that information. Is it hard to get that information from the FBI? What do you have to do?
Well, I must say that I found the FBI Freedom of Information Act section very cooperative and courteous, and I both in my telephone communications with them and in writing to them. I think they were trying to uphold a law which they had to, which had been approved by Congress and the president. I found the FBI rather cooperative. However, I found many of the pages either withheld in their entirety or heavily censored. And this was a judgment call on the part of those who were censoring it. I think they were trying to uphold the law. However, I did notice during the Reagan administration in the last couple of years, and I started this nearly 5 years ago, in the last 2 years, the procedures have been tightened up so that it's getting to be a little more difficult and a little longer to get these files. There were other agencies, other intelligence agencies, who were far less cooperative than the FBI, and that was the CIA, and especially the State Department Intelligence Bureau, and the intelligence branches of the three armed forces, All of them were far less cooperative, strangely enough, than the FBI. The FBI centralized these documents from the other agencies, and so, in a sense, they cannot be condemned for lacking information, because some of the information that was held from me came from other intelligence agencies.
While you were going through all this trouble of getting the files on other writers, did you get one on yourself?
Well, I asked that very question of E.L. Doctorow, and he said he's written away for it, for his file, and he'd like to be in the great company of these half-dozen Nobel laureates. I'm curious. I have written away for my own. I'm waiting to hear.
So you don't know if there is one on you or not?
I wouldn't be surprised if there is. As I say, I'm not in the class of Das Passos and Thomas Wolfe and Dashiell Hammett and A.J. Liebling and Nelson Algren and Maxwell Anderson and all the playwrights in the book, Thornton Wilder. All of them had files, when I asked Ed Doctorow that, he says it's sort of an honors list. It's like being on Nixon's hit list. I've spoken to a few people who were off it who were rather offended.
I bet that one of the outcomes of your book is that a lot of writers are asking you to help them get their Freedom of Information Act files. Is that happening?
Well, that's good. That's absolutely true, and I've heard from a number of them. And I said it's easier than you think, even though there's a much longer wait now. You have to write away under the Freedom of Information Act and give a little basic information about where you were born and what you were doing, and that you have some legitimate purpose in finding out about yourself. You don't have to give too many details, and take a chance at it.
Okay, well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Herbert Mittgang. He writes about books and writers for the New York Times. His new book is titled Dangerous Dossiers, Exposing the Secret War Against America's Greatest Authors. It's published by Donald Fine. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with singer and actor Kris Kristofferson. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, Al Franken does Pat Robertson and Paul Simon. He's performed his political characterizations on Saturday Night Live, the show he's written for off and on since it premiered in 1975. Also, rock and roll historian Ed Ward remembers the band Brinsley Schwartz. Their records flopped, but their live performances helped give rise to the pub rock scene. And book critic John Leonard reviews two new biographies about controversial attorney Roy Cohn. Cohn first made a name for himself as Joe McCarthy's right-hand man during the 50s. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson. Panamanian General Manuel Noriega's offer to step down from power in due time got a cold reception today from opposition leaders who want Noriega to leave Panama immediately. But the Noriega regime may have gained some negotiating time with its proposal for a Panamanian solution to the country's current crisis. Tom Gelton reports.
The Noriega offer to resign sometime before next year's election process gets underway was announced last night by acting Panamanian President Manuel Solis Palma. But Solis said he would not accept Noriega's offer unless political opposition groups in Panama agree to a national dialogue with the government. Opposition leaders said today that's a hollow deal. Several even questioned whether Noriega really did offer to resign. None agreed to the dialogue request. The Solis Palma proposal may have won the Noriega regime some bargaining room, however. Diplomats from Latin American countries pointed out that the ambiguity surrounding Noriega's offer could mean the general is still considering a quick exit from Panama, but is not yet ready to announce it. In Panama City, I'm Tom Gelton.
In Washington, the State Department has also rejected Panamanian General Noriega's offer to resign. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
State Department spokesman Charles Redmond said the U.S. could not accept the Panamanian government's offer last night of Noriega's resignation by May 1989. Redmond said the ongoing general strike has been successful and indicates the Panamanian people want Noriega to leave the country immediately.
The Panamanian opposition regards big statements of Noriega's willingness to step down in the distant future as a ploy to buy time. We agree. We have not altered our policy toward the illegal Noriega regime.
Meanwhile, the Panamanian Air Force major claiming to have been Noriega's personal pilot said today the general has been trying to get cash from Libya through Cuba. Major Augusto Villalas said he was instructed to pick up $50 million in Havana during an arms procuring trip. A State Department spokesman said there was no way to confirm Villalas's account. Villalas was presented at a news conference by New York Senator Alfonso de Mato, who called on the administration to extradite Noriega. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
In Sipawa, Nicaragua, the peace talks between the U.S.-backed Contras and the Sandinista government are continuing in spite of serious differences which remain between the two sides. But sources close to the Sandinistas indicate their government is willing to make some concessions. Charles Castaldi reports.
Both sides today tabled proposals for the establishment of a ceasefire, which reflect the deep differences that still divide them. The Contras proposed a 45-day truce, during which time the Sandinistas are to make a series of concessions, including the suspension of the draft and giving opposition parties the right to own a television station. The Contras say that a permanent ceasefire would be worked out at later meetings in the 45-day period. Sources close to the Sandinistas said that they have tabled a concession, which would allow the Contra groups to seek amnesty and simultaneously name representatives for the Contras inside Nicaragua. It appears this is the first time the Sandinistas have shown willingness to discuss political issues in the talks. So far, there has been no reaction from the Contras. For National Public Radio, this is Charles Castaldi in Sapoa, Nicaragua.
Military officials say American forces in Honduras will complete a full 10 to 14 days of training exercises, even though the border crisis with Nicaraguan troops appears to be over. The Supreme Court ruled today that peaceful picketing must be allowed at foreign embassies in Washington. By a 5-3 vote, the justices said a federal law that allows embassies to have picketers arrested if their signs are deemed offensive is unconstitutional. The court said picketers can be arrested if they pose a threat to an embassy's peace and security. And the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed today at 2065.98. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. With a name like Brinsley Schwartz, how far could a rock band be expected to go? Rock and roll historian Ed Ward says that after a shaky start back in the late 60s, Brinsley Schwartz, the band and the man, gave us some rock and roll magic.
If there are two pop music myths that I'd prefer to believe, they would be these. First, that you can't force a phenomenon to happen, and second, that the good stuff will always win out. Of course, that's a lot of wishful thinking, but occasionally it's just what happens. Take the case of Brinsley Schwartz, for instance. Brinsley Schwartz, the band, began life as Kippington Lodge, a sort of nondescript hippie band operating around London in the late 60s. The guitarist was a fairly talented guy named Brinsley Schwartz, and the bass player was a prolific songwriter named Nick Lowe. Along with keyboardist Bob Andrews and drummer Billy Rankin, they were doing all right until a management firm called Fame Pushers Limited got a hold of them. Fame Pushers decided this band was the next big thing, and in what must have been one of the most horribly misguided campaigns of all time, flew a plane load of British journalists to the Fillmore East to witness the band's American debut. The poor press guys weren't even allowed a day to get over their jet lag, and the band, nervous as could be, played a lousy set. On top of that, the first album was pretty mediocre, and it got roasted. The band went back to London. That should have been the end of it, but it wasn't. The band decided to stick it out, and late in 1970 put out a second album with the understandable title, Despite It All. Songs like Country Girl were totally unlike anything being done in England at the time, and sounded a lot more like an American group like The Band than anything else. But everybody was still feeling burned by the Fame Pushers experience, and the Brinsleys lost their big record contract in America. They'd get two albums on United Artists in 1971 and 72, but to all intents and purposes, they disappeared. Still, the music they were making was getting better as they were getting more obscure. They were, as the song says, happy doing what they were doing, and it sounded like it. So much so that by their third album, Silver Pistol, they were threatening to get so laid back they'd just stop. Once I made a fortune, but I wouldn't play their stupid games with these orders to the Holy Land and a silver. But then something remarkable happened. Along with a couple of other bands like Ducks Deluxe and Bees Make Honey, Brinsley Schwartz had started a sort of anti-scene. People who were put off by the glam rock posturing of Elton John and David Bowie could hear well-made rock and roll in informal and inexpensive surroundings. Pub rock, it was called, a reminder that the deep meaning that some performers were trying to impose on poor old rock and roll wasn't the point. Something really gone. Some people, they were dancing, and some were clapping hands, and some others were just lying close, making sweet romance. But the hour was growing later, and the party had shoving fun. And when Frankie said, come on, let's break it up, everybody spoke out in one. Play that bad thing one more time. Yeah. Does something to me to make them so fine. Songs like Play That Fast Thing One More Time were just fun. For various reasons, lack of money for one, the band fell apart at the end of 1974, but not before delivering their masterpiece, the new favorites of Brinsley Schwartz, 10 amazing songs, including this one.
Searching for light in the darkness of insanity. Oh yeah, I ask myself, is all hope gone? Is there only pain, hatred and misery? Oh yeah, and each time I feel like this inside, there's one thing.
As the cynical 70s began to take hold, Brinsley Schwartz, as unfashionable as ever, asked the important musical question, what's so funny about peace, love, and understanding? Elvis Costello asked the same question 4 years later on his album Armed Forces, produced by the Brinsleys' bass player, Nick Lowe. The band may be gone, but I think people may yet discover that their songs really had staying power.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll, and he writes for the Austin Chronicle. This is Fresh Air. Primary season has been a fertile period for Saturday Night Live's Al Franken.
Senator Simon, why the bow tie?
Pat, my advisors have been begging me for years to get rid of the bow tie. But with Paul Simon, what you see is what you get. And I'm not about to change my bow tie to please some media advisor. And so I wear the bow tie.
Part of developing a caricature is either your caricature determines the joke you write or the joke you're writing determines the caricature. And we're just trying to find something for each, a joke for each guy.
Al Franken has been coming up with jokes for more than 13 years. Along with his partner, Tom Davis, Franken has worked with NBC's Saturday Night Live on and off since its inception in 1975. He's been a writer, a producer, a performer, and a writer again. This season, at least until the Writers Guild strike, Al Franken has co-written and performed in the show's political lampoons, appearing in the candidates' debates as Pat Robertson and Paul Simon.
And something that really irritated me about Simon was they'd ask him why the bow tie, and he'd always go into this explanation of how it reflects how he is not afraid to be different and all this stuff. And a tie is a tie, you know? So he should say, because I like bow ties, and it has nothing to do with anything else. So that's why the joke was the hook with him. Another phrase that he says a lot are hopes and dreams, and Hubert Humphrey, but he says hopes and dreams. If you watch him, he'll talk about the hopes and dreams of the people who voted for him, and he talked about it after the Illinois primary again. So you'll hear hopes and dreams every time you see Paul Simon.
You get this great deliberateness in your voice when you do him.
Well, he is a deliberate guy. I like Paul Simon.
Now, are you rooting for Pat Robertson and Paul Simon so that you can get to caricature them longer as they stay in the race?
No.
You're more serious about politics than that.
Yeah, yeah. It'd be, you know, it'd be nice in a way for my career if Paul Simon won or if Pat Robertson won, but no, I could live without the career boost of Pat Robertson becoming president.
Reverend Robertson, you bristled Monday when Tom Brokaw called you a television evangelist. Why?
Well, Pat, this is a deliberate attempt by the media to belittle me, and I'm just not going to stand for it. I've been so many things besides a religious broadcaster. I'm a businessman. I'm president of the sixth largest cable TV network in the country. I've mowed lawns. I've been a babysitter. I've watched people's homes while they went on vacation. I've been a caddy at a country club, one of the largest country clubs in the state of Virginia. And I think that the media, by ignoring these other positions I've had and focusing on 25-odd years of my hosting an evangelical show, I think it's just unfair, and it's just religious bigotry.
Now, come on now, Pat. That's a load of bunk. You know and I know that you're an old Bible-something revival show con artist from way back, claimed to heal people. I'll tell you something, Pat Robertson. You turn to me and heal my right arm, and I'll be glad to step aside and let you be present.
I've been doing Pat Robertson, or sort of a cross between Pat Robertson and Jim Baker, for about 10 years. Part of being in show business is you get to wake up late. And I used to wake up late and turn on TV, and I'd get the PTL Club and I'd get the 700 Club. So I used to watch them, and one day Jim Baker said something that sort of locked me into his character and also Pat Robertson's character, which is the happy evangelist. Jim Baker said, we had a party last Friday, and when it comes to getting down, nobody gets down like we Christians. And I said, that's a character. Now I do Jim Baker a little. I do everyone like Pat Robertson now because I've been working on my Pat Robertson so much. But Pat Robertson also does a thing because he's always happy. But sometimes he almost sounds like Barney Fife. When he gets very happy.
Yeah, you really get this perpetual TV smile in his face and in his voice when you do him.
Yeah, he gets serious every once in a while. And when he does, sometimes that neck muscle comes down, you know, where that lower lip exposes his bottom teeth. And he sort of shuts his eyes a little bit when he's about to say something serious.
Have you ever met him?
Gee, no, I haven't.
Do you think it's something of a status symbol for politicians to be caricatured on the show?
It depends how people are making fun of you. You know, when Gary Hart started being made fun of in the way he has been, it was sort of the death knell. I mean, one of the death knells for his candidacy. So it depends what they're doing to you.
Well, politicians, I think, like to show that they get the joke and that they have a sense of humor. But for the ones that you've met, have you found that to be true, that they have a sense of humor?
Well, Dole clearly has a sense of humor about most things. And, geez, I doubt Bush does. I don't know. I can't imagine he does. Let's see. You know, I haven't met a lot of these guys. Simon I met because he did the show. Babbitt has a great sense of humor. And he did our show, and he was a great guy.
So you traveled around the primaries?
I traveled to Iowa and New Hampshire just to get a flavor of the campaign. And after that, it scattered for Super Tuesday so much. And now we're on strike. I'm in the Writers Guild. So I'm really not going out on the trail now.
Were there any great moments you can share with us while you were doing your research?
None that I can share with you.
Were you ever recognized when you were in Iowa observing the caucuses there?
Well, yeah, you know, the media people certainly recognized me around the hotel and stuff like that. One the night of the Iowa caucuses, I went to a Republican and a Democratic caucus in Mingo, Iowa, and I went with Ken Bodie, the NBC political correspondent, and he picked Mingo for a couple reasons. But anyway, I went out there because I wanted to see what the process was, and we went to the first one we went to was a Republican one, and there were only about 20 people there. And then after it was over, the chairman of the caucus said, "We'd like the members of the press to identify themselves and say hi." And Ken Bodie said, "I'm Ken Bodie from NBC News." And Larry Grossman said, "I'm Larry Grossman, head of NBC News." And it got to me, and I was like, "Oh boy, I have no real legitimate reason to be here, and these people are going to think I'm making fun of them." Al Franken, I'm a writer for Saturday Night Live, but honest, I'm not going to make fun of you people. I'm just here because I wanted to see it. And they were all very friendly, even though they were Republicans. They were actually very sweet people.
But let's face it, you really were there to make fun of them.
Don't tell them that. You don't tell them. Well, in good conscience, I decided not to do a sketch on a caucus after making my pledge to them, because I just really wanted to get out of the room.
It must be very frustrating to you to have the writer's strike in progress during primary season.
Yep.
Not much you can do about it, though, huh?
Nope. I was actually on the picket line last week, and they gave me the bullhorn because they thought I might be good on the bullhorn. So I yelled, "More money, more money, more money." And one of the soap opera writers rushed up to me and said, "Don't put it in those terms."
Tomorrow in part two of our conversation, Al Franken talks about his conflicts with network censors, and he runs through a sketch that censors thought too tasteless for television. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with co-host Robert Siegel and see what they have planned. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What's coming up?
Well, we're following events throughout Central America, the ceasefire talks in Nicaragua, the meaning of this week's election in El Salvador, and also what's happening in Panama. In this country, we have a report by Barbara Mantell in New York about the stockholder resolution that's been raised for the AT&T annual meeting that would end affirmative action at AT&T. It's being brought against the management's desires by a white supremacist group that actually made the proposal. We also talk with somebody who's brought many, many stockholder resolutions down through the years against various companies about why he does it.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. From the 1950s, when he served as chief counsel to Senator Joe McCarthy, until his death 2 years ago, Roy Cohn was one of the most controversial public figures of our time. Two new books about Cohn have just been published. One is a biography by Nicholas von Hoffman. The other is a quasi-autobiography of Cohn by Sidney Zion. Book critic John Leonard has this review.
Welcome to Sleaze. You may remember Roy Cohn and his sleepy lizard look from black and white TV in the 1950s, when he was Senator Joe McCarthy's right-hand hatchet man going after pinkos and queers in the State Department and the U.S. Army. You might have wondered what happened to him between then and now that's worth two books. What happened is that he became a New York City celebrity, a pal of loudmouths like master builder Donald Trump and sports brat George Steinbrenner, a mouthpiece for mobsters like Carmine Galenti and disco delinquents like Studio 54's Steve Rubell, a pet of gossip columnists to whom he fed the dirt from J. Edgar Hoover's private files, a fixer of judges and elections, a welsher on loans from his own clients, a lazy lawyer disbarred for flimflam, owing over $7 million in back taxes. After a career of gay bashing and a lifetime in the closet, he died in 1986 of AIDS. Some found Roy Cohn amusing. Sidney Zion, a lawyer himself who's reported for periodicals as various as Ramparts and the New York Times, is one of them. Cohn was always good for the inside scoop, and Zion, in this autobiography, lets Cohn brag into a tape recorder. This bragging has a certain charm, like memoirs of mafia hitmen. A corruption so instinctive and shameless appeals to the rogue in us, so long as we're not on its receiving end. But of course, Cohn apparently lied to Zion and to himself, and Zion's too buddy-buddy to bestir himself to check out such unsavories as the porno movie house in Jersey, the Mosler loan, the Holzer betrayal, the Gallagher libel, or the Abe Feller suicide. Why ruin a good yarn? Whereas Nicholas von Hoffman, in Citizen Cohn, checks out all these stories and writes with a sword. Yes, Roy had an awful mother, and Bobby Kennedy was out to get him, and at least one of D.A. Robert Morgenthau's indictments seems to have been trumped up. But from von Hoffman's exhaustive account of backstabbing in the Bronx judiciary and book burning all over Europe in the McCarthy years and influence peddling in our highest courts and hanky-panky with Walter Winchell, Frank Costello, Barbara Walters, Liz Smith, and Cardinal Spellman, it's impossible not to gag, not least at Cohn's corruption of the media that fed on and protected him, and his abuse of the legal system of which he was a sometime officer. Inside Cohn's skin, von Hoffman screams. There's a terrible emptiness there, and a self-hating ambivalence about being a Jew, and a desperate denial of his own sexuality that he maintained to the bitter end, even on 60 Minutes with Mike Wallace. And from these, a sympathetic psychoanalyst might embroider an excuse. But what excuse is there for a culture that celebrates a Cohn and his contempt for the decencies of public and private behavior? There's even something sick in our avid reading of books about him.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine, and as a columnist for New York Newsday, he reviewed Citizen Cohn by Nicholas von Hoffman and the autobiography of Roy Cohn by Sidney Zion. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow, part two of my conversation with Saturday Night Live writer and comedian Al Franken. We'll hear about what happens behind the scenes and in the censor's office. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz will review the latest recording from the young British conductor Simon Rattle and his City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg will discuss shibboleths, those obscure points of etymology that mean so much to language purists and so little to the rest of us. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Today's show is produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Ed Doherty. Production assistance from Lisa Bruton and Warren Kozak. Our engineer is Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.